And welcome to Radio Book Club. I'm David Cheesham, and I'm here on the phone with Cheryl Cox Williams, the president-elect of the NAACP Anchorage. She's a retired Army veteran, an entrepreneur, and a financial literacy coach. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for the invitation, David.
Oh, man. We are talking about the novel by the Nobel Prize-winning Toni Morrison. The novel is The Bluest Eye. I don't think Toni Morrison would mind me saying that this is a hard, hard book. Don't you think?
Fair, fair assessment.
The star of the story is Piccola, a black girl. She's internalized racialized standards of beauty and ugliness. She's broken by this. Her biggest longing is to have blue eyes. And we find out very early in the book that she has been sexually abused by her father. That's kind of the, like you say, that's the headline for the book. But the book goes deeper than that, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. Much, much deeper.
What did you think of the book? How did it impact you? This is not the first time you've read it, right?
No. I started the book back in 1986, to date myself, my first year in college. And it was all the buzz because it was being banned back then. And I was in New York City at the time. And we were young and brash, and this was something we could sink our teeth into.
Wow. Yeah.
And now I'm a grandma, and they're doing it again.
That's right. Yeah, the it has been banned all over the country, including here in the Mat-Su. Has there been discussions in Anchorage about banning the book?
The list here keeps changing, so. Mm-hmm. At the time of this conversation, I can't confirm or deny.
Okay. It is a hard book to read. I mean, these are difficult subjects, but they're dealt with such artistry and in such depth. What are some of the parts of the book that are most intriguing to you?
Well, I am one of those psychology graduates, you know,
right.
Here at UAA. And we actually had to study the work of Dr. Kenneth Clark and his wife, Mamie Phipps Clark, and they did the doll study.
Uh-huh.
The Clarks did the full-on first psychological research just on this subject. What do children feel is beautiful? And these plastic diaper-clad dolls that were identical in everything except for color, the African-American children chose the white doll as what they considered beautiful.
Oh, my. And where does that come from?
Racial self-loathing.
Hmm.
We can throw in a little Stockholm syndrome,
right.
Empathizing with the kidnapper, embodying what we see as power. Power shows up physically as white or light. Our images on television, in our magazines, all show that the successful or the prosperous would be light or white. The embodying it as the color of the eye, which is the rarest color available, would put you at the pinnacle of the power structure.
And I can just think of so many ways that this novel captures that. Did she write this before that study, or was that study, do you remember when that study was made?
See, I don't test well. But
okay, that's okay. But I even if it's not relevant, because she deals with this, you know, as an artist, she just captures this thing. She may or may not have read that study, but she has her own experience. I know in the introduction, Toni talks about meeting somebody who as a child, wanted blue eyes, who's, you know, and that was the instigation for this, for the novel. There are so many ways that that racial self-loathing pops up in the book, and the different characters, and different different levels of intensity. Maybe the characters feel real. They feel like whole characters and complex characters. They're not villains and heroes. They are people who suffer like human beings and cause suffering like human beings.
They are composites of scenarios that we all go through, whether it be domestic violence, the sexual abuse, engaging with the mind of a pedophile, or is it, rape and incest? Yeah. These are all messy subjects that come up in everybody's life, regardless of their hue. Tony, as an artist, is able to weave it into characters that are believable, even though they are in absolutely impossible situations. The situations are not new. And fighting your way every day through these situations will cause psychological degradation. You know, you're just one step lower every day if you don't have the necessary supports around you.
Right.
Ficola is a composite of right. all of the tributaries that run into her river of life.
Mm.
You know, it was the need to have time spent on her father's background, making him who he was, talking about her mother's disability that started as an accident at age of two.
Right.
You know, their lives are all so uncontrollable. The things that impacted them, you know, how many folks have a father that was found in a dumpster? What kind of person does that person grow up to be, right. if not troubled and deranged? And just like a statistic, what did he do to his family? As head of household, he destroyed it. He destroyed it with his alcoholism, with his the emasculation that he experienced in his youth. During a very poignant time in his life, all of these things dictated the kind of person he would become
right.
and the kind of family that he would guide, because he had no guide, so he didn't know how to guide.
And he certainly didn't know how to love. And I love the character of of his wife, Mrs. Breedlove, Polly. She escapes in movies, and these movies have the same white faces with blue eyes that Piccolo wants to mirror in her life.
We are reflections of our parents.
Yeah.
They're good, they're bad, and they're ugly. In psychology, we call that modeling. We model a behavior. And behavior transmission happens in so many ways. Some are subtle and some are not. We have a time where the girls are given dolls. And guess what? They're white dolls with light hair, fine hair that do not reflect them. And everyone was absolutely appalled at the behavior that one of our characters had, right? Because she didn't like the doll.
Right.
Like, how could you not like that doll? That's a beautiful doll. That doll doesn't look anything like me. You wouldn't want a doll that looks like you. How much more powerful could you get on a child's mind than telling them that something that reflects them is ugly? They don't know what you said, but they know how that made them feel.
And I think it was Claudia, the daughter who bucks the system, and she doesn't like the dolls. She rips them apart to try to figure out how they work. She was my favorite character in the book because she was a survivor. What did you think of her and her family?
Well, the best part for me is, as I read, I felt she had a future. Yeah. She wasn't going to be underfoot. She was going to stand up to the best of her ability. And that gave me hope. Tony gave us that early on to realize that there was somebody a little different that we were going to be discussing, and that was Claudia.
Yeah.
The reason for Claudia would have to be that Claudia had a sibling that she could talk in her own level of understanding to. Mm-hmm. She had a mother that was hardworking, but at the end of the day, when I have pains and I have stressors, I need somebody closer to my age to understand my current lived experience. And her sister was there most of the time, whether they were getting themselves in trouble or trying to understand something as simple as the first time a young girl starts her menstruation. Because we keep that also in a shroud of mystery.
Yeah.
The simplicity of their understanding of it was laughable and sad.
Yeah. Some amazing storytelling with that, and to see that from a child's point of view, that's a brilliant, brilliant piece of the writing in the book there. And I hate to see people.
I also enjoyed that she spent time doing the conversation of it all, you know, versus describing it. Let's have the conversation about it. The interruptions that even you and I are having right now, you know, the broken sentence, the you know what I'm talking about, understanding about what is left unsaid. That kept me engaged in the reading of it because I also had a vested interest in how I was visually eavesdropping on a conversation.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's. And there were some other moments that I gravitated to, the use of the word outside to mean somebody's been kicked out of their home. And the girls don't understand the word ruined. Did you find that kind of both sad and funny at the same time when they don't know what their parents mean when they say, or what adults mean when they say, this girl's ruined? And you've made me understand how that is. How they gave each other strength, the siblings gave each other strength.
It's, again, a story that's as old as time, but it has to have been part of your time, your lived experience. Language is something that we create. You know, that's why the folks that live on the other side of the sea and of the ocean have a different way that they communicate. You create language so that the people that are around you can understand what you're trying to convey. And it's taught to you not by pointing at things, but you associating it with other things. So they knew ruined was not good.
Right.
They had no idea that it had any sexual connotation because that's not where their lived experience is. So I know that if somebody says ruined, my mom reacts very poorly. So stay away from that ruined person. And it was even more evident when they tried to use it out of context. Because when they said it to somebody, they're like, is that right? I didn't understand that. Tell me more. I can't tell you more. That's all I know.
Yep.
So, yes, I do share that it was sad but true, and more of the truth about how in 2023, our young people are hearing and being immersed in different languages that the adults are using. They don't have a lived experience about it, but they're asked to make decisions about it. And this is also the fault, again, of how do we respect our children? How do we pay attention to the cues that they're giving? Because language, in the psychology of it all, is not just through spoken word. You know, there's body language. There's the importance of a facial expression when I say the words. It's where I said the word and who I was saying it to. Because if I'm at the workplace, there's a slew of words that are unacceptable here, but perfectly acceptable at home. And they have a different meaning in context. This whole book and the way that it was so delicately woven for you needs context. It's not a piece of pornography written to just slather these descriptors out there. It is a very delicately woven tapestry of pain, encouragement, disdain, lack of understanding this context will take you to a place where you try to break it into pieces. This cannot be broken into pieces to be understood. It needs to be woven to explain the why a behavior has occurred, the who perpetrated the behavior, and the context for the location that that behavior was displayed. Right. It is doing a disservice to the artist, Toni Morrison, to take a couple of paragraphs to describe all that was here. I'm Jamaican born. This was written by a Black American about a Ohio-based experience.
Right.
So do I think I fully understand what I read? Just because I have a similar hue? This would make an amazing social studies book because of the layering of what a Southern American Black went through during Jim Crow to what is happening in the Midwest and the North with Blacks and what it takes for a family to muster the financial courage, the mental courage, and the social courage to want to leave what is familiar, even if it's uncomfortable, it is what's familiar, and make a trek with your family to what is absolutely unknown with the promise of freedom. Toni spent some chapters describing the beauty, the physical outdoor beauty of the South. The smells, the taste, the ease in which people spoke and dressed, to thinking freedom was concrete streets and tenement buildings and tight shoes and putting chemicals in your hair to straighten it, which in that day and age would burn the scalp. You would have to know all of that to soak in one of her sentences. Yeah. So just breezing over that book and trying to read it very quickly would be the same experience I had with my children when they were teenagers and we were both watching the movie Shrek. And we both got excited when we heard a certain song. And I was like, how do you know that song? That's the best song in Shrek. And I'm going, no, it's the anthem of my childhood. No, it's just a song from Shrek. Don't get too excited. Out of context.
And yet when people go up to school boards, they pick out passages and they read those passages and they say, well, this is what the whole book is about. And it's a disservice to the book and the author, and it's a disservice to the potential readers who might need that context and might understand the world a little bit better if they decide to delve into that story.
We don't give that kind of time to anything right now. Yeah. Folks roll their eyes if it takes more than 30 minutes to make dinner. But what you do get is the fact that this book is back on the list again. We have not discussed something like age appropriateness, just like our movies. What age is appropriate to read this book? That's what I would probably show up at the school board to talk about. Mm-hmm. Because I don't put words in anybody's mouth, and you shouldn't put words in Toni Morrison's mouth, that she said this was for middle schoolers. You know, this is a very mature subject matter that needs to be covered and discussed. This should not be something that's read as part of my 50 books this year. This is something that you will read and reread. And for me, the first time I read it, I was in my early 20s. Now I'm in my mid-50s. These old women that are being discussed in the book have some resemblance to me.
Yes, yes.
When they say that they feel free, I can now look you square in the eye and go, I don't know any other time of my life that I have felt free to be me, because every Black woman wakes up every day to care for others. Hmm. When they were a young girl, they cared for their family and their father. When they became a young woman, they cared for their husband and their children. And even when we become grandmothers, there's no better iconic image than Big Mama, that everybody goes to her house and that matriarch still presides over her family.
Yeah.
And we fight tooth and nail, knowing that in the pecking order of power, we must protect those that are in our charge. And this book brings our attention to the most delicate, which is a child, the most vulnerable, which is a young girl, and the most powerless, which is a young Black girl. Our entire system is designed to emasculate our males, disrespect our women, overly sexualize our women, and to create a sense of hopelessness for our boys and a weakness that is nothing less than a bleak narrative of psychological murder. This demonizing of an entire race has been internalized. We're fighting to love the way we were designed. The curls and the softness of our hair, the smoothness of our skin, the way our bodies grow, whether it's horizontally or vertically, we are designed to be beautiful in our own eyes. But there is not a policy, a system, or a program that reflects that back to us. You know, everybody understands that they get rejected sometimes. Everybody understands that you might get hated for something that you can't change and that it's unjustified. We all understand that. But do we understand an entire race that goes through that every single day, every waking hour? That is generational PTSD.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was just hearing a report on research into trauma and how now with brain studies they're able to identify all kinds, you know, not just physical trauma, but mental trauma and how that daily internalizing of that self-loathing has the same impact on the brain as what we traditionally think of as trauma, which is kind of an immediate, horrible act. Toni Morrison didn't have access to that research, but she knew it. You know, that's in this book. It's in this novel.
Yeah, you can feel it. And it was in the 1940s that Dr. Kenneth and Mamie Clark did the doll test.
Okay.
And their experiments were used in Brown versus Board of Education.
Oh, no, I feel like I should have known that. But, yeah, Toni, that would have reflected, you know, she would surely be thinking about that when she wrote this.
Yeah, and of course, our NAACP lawyers had a big part in this study being used in the Supreme Court justice case on this.
Yeah.
It was 14 years in the making, this study.
It's amazing.
You know, so there you are in 1940s doing a study, Board of Education in the 50s, and Civil Rights and Lyndon B. in the 60s. Again, would this have made any impact at any other time in our written record? It's all context, what was going on in the world at the time. We needed support from the family, the friends, and the allies. That's the only way we're able to get through tough things. And that's why having these two disparate families as the subjects of the book, you were able to draw your own comparison of what these different elements in a young person's life will do for their future. You know, Toni didn't use a single parent home. They were both homes that had fathers present. But what having a father present looks like shows up very differently. When your renter in your home fondles your daughter and you beat him till he wants to wish that he was never born, that's the father that Claudia had.
Right.
Versus you are being molested by your father and you don't tell him because you feel like nobody's going to care. So just having the elements is not what we need. It's having the truth and the good and the encouraging to be present. Both of those mothers worked till their hands were calloused and their backs were arched. But when one mother came home, she chose how she interacted with her children. The other mother came and just zipped it open and flung it across the room. All the weeping and the woe that she had in her heart.
And so powerful, and the world she creates with so many different ways of responding to the overall racism and society that are shown in the book. It's amazing.
It takes a person who observes people to do what Tony did. Because if I said her hands were rough, you go, okay, hands were rough. She said they were calloused and marred and they made a sound when they touched things. Wow, those are some really rough hands.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of attention to detail makes this book, again, the work of an artist and a stylist.
Yeah.
Because there's a style of storytelling that makes you paint your own image in your mind. Or you can smell that flavor. Or you can taste and feel the texture of what that person in the book is eating. And then you get into your head space where you are transported to where they are. And you can feel that breeze that she's talking about. You can see that person slumped over the kitchen sink. You can imagine what it looks like to pick up one leg and scratch your calf.
Yeah.
That seems so random, but I could imagine it.
You're right there. There's a reason why Toni Morrison won the Nobel Prize for Literature. She's just a rare talent, and you showed that in the examples that you brought up. It's so moving and so real. You are right there.
Another place for a psychology student was the manic behavior that gets displayed and described. You know, Father Charlie was villain and victim.
Mm-hmm.
He was the sweetest when he was a lover, and he was the hardest when he was a fighter. He loved hard and he fought harder, but he chose to fight the ones he was supposed to love.
Right.
Yeah. He was weak when they needed him to be strong. The juxtaposition of the angst that the men in this story go through. A young boy goes looking for his father.
Yeah.
He finds him. And the name of his mother escapes him. how bizarre.
Yeah.
He finds him after being heroic that a young boy could manage to get as far as he did with his own volition. And you reach what's supposed to be the climax of a happy ending, only to be trumped by, who are you? Who is your mother? I don't have any money. Go away. As unceremonious an anticlimax you could possibly have. And then for her to take it even further to, like, have him soil himself because he's now losing control. He was holding it together. Your mind holds all of your body functions. He was holding it together to get to this spot, to get to this time. This was going to be his release of all the bad that he has just experienced. He was going to his Mecca, and he lost it. And his mind lost it, and his body lost it. He lost control of his bodily functions. How hard did you get hit mentally that you just lost control? Spend a moment in that young person's mind that he had given up the ghost. I have nothing left. I can't control anything. And he loses control of his bowels. The wrong person reading that goes, ew. No, this was a significant emotional experience. And in that moment, he came unhinged. He no longer cared. He no longer had compassion. He no longer connected to anybody or anything. He was like a paper plane in the wind. Or if you're writing it Toni Morrison style, a blowing in the wind. Mm-hmm. And that became somebody's dad? That's where you're supposed to pause. Not over the soiling of his pants. That was giving you clear indication of how fragile we are mentally. And for us to be looking into these pages about young people, they're not fully formed. Their brains are not fully formed.
Just how devastating and how, like you say, emasculating that has to be. It's just, it's amazing. What do you say to that?
Well, you fast forward to 2023, and you say, are we still having racial self-loathing issues? And I go, yes, we do. They're worse now because we have gone into the spaces and places that we fought really hard to be in, and we're still not welcomed. So we're going to continue to model behaviors we feel from our internalizing will make us more successful. We leave our neighborhoods that we were raised in, and we go to neighborhoods where we have nobody that looks like us, because we need to be in that neighborhood to be powerful, because that's where all the powerful people live. So I need to live there, and I'm not welcomed there. So I overdo everything. I overdo decorating, I overdo my grass, I overdo my car, I overdo stressing out my children. They're going to take Chinese and ballet and violin, and they're going to have a social calendar that rivals an international supermodel. Because these are all the things that show that I'm powerful. And when I go to work, I'm going to micromanage because I cannot afford for anybody to see me make a mistake. My hair will look like their hair. My makeup will look like their makeup. My clothes will look like their clothes. The tone of my voice will sound like the tone of their voice. And when I'm done code switching, I don't know if I'm switching to be at home or switching to be at work or switching to present or switching to talk. I will be so muddled in my mind that when I go to see my own family, my blood, that's still in the neighborhood that raised me and cared for me, I will look at them with disdain. I will wonder out loud to them, why aren't you doing this thing and that thing to be like those people? I will not love purely and surely. I will have angst. I will have worry. And I will need mental support because I've cut myself off from my tribe. There's nobody like Claudia and her sister for me. I am Piccola again, helpless and struggling in a space that calls me ugly. We have to fight for natural hair to be on television. It's a thing. It's a very recent thing. There's a young man in Texas that wore his hair in dreads. And the school told him that's not school code. His parents have to fight for him to have his natural hair. A newscaster who is qualified, maybe even overqualified, is not allowed to be an anchor because she wants to wear her natural hair. It's even more damaging now because we can't see the scars. Mental health has become a very real and poignant problem in Black and brown families. In Alaska, we already know that we're on the bottom of the charts of things that are good and on the top of the charts of things that are bad. The things that are covered in Tony's book happen every day in our great state. And we've got the numbers to back it up. So anybody who doesn't want to talk about this has their head under the snow.
Yeah, and they're perpetuating it by not talking about it.
They're, what is it called? You're an enabler.
Yeah.
You're enabling this kind of behavior to continue. And if you read this book, you would know that the pedophile is the upstanding person in the community. That's not shooting rounds at every upstanding person in the community, but there's several indicators that would have warned people that were paying attention that this person had a couple of screws loose. But instead, you let young people go visit him and revisit him. That was the part that just took my breath away.
Yeah.
Revisit him.
Yeah.
And his story was the one that, as a Jamaican out of a British Commonwealth, you know, we have his story peppered in my own bloodline. So you never expect that the eldest brother from England left to come to Jamaica. right? The eldest is going to be inheriting everything. So you know that the colonists were either the younger brothers or, you know, the illegitimate son of somebody that came to the Indies. So in my own story, and thanks to, you know, technology and coming to live in Alaska where your genealogy can affect your inheritance in the corporations, I became acquainted with the DNA testing services and submitted mine only to open up a whole new chapter of my experience as a phenotype Black, which is now my running joke, because according to my DNA, 76% of who I am is anything but Black. And, you know, with the, what is it, 4% of Nordic, you know, that had to go way back.
Right.
You know, I've got the Iberian Peninsula in there, and of course, English and Scottish, but that was a given. I would never have guessed the Nordic, and I also got to kind of zero in on where in Africa the majority of my African descent comes from. And it took me into some more exploration about, you know, shipping routes and things like that. And it informs me reading The Bluest Eye.
Yeah.
Why? Because we have now somebody digitized records in England, and we have the will of one of my ancestors that the white side of the family had, right? Huh. So they're called the Burkes, and we find out that, of course, one of the Burkes was a plantation owner, and he wrote in to his will that his children by an African woman, she is unnamed, kind of like in the Bible, the children from this African woman have been given property, and that time that this happened, they could also go to school. So from these Burkes, we have the first solicitor in Jamaica, which would be your version of a lawyer today, right?
Right.
That one decision from, how did she say it? That, you know, Warren Earl, that's how she said it in the book. Right. I don't presume that my Burke was an Earl, but from that one white man making the decision to put his seed into a will and give them property changed the trajectory of our lives, right? That's... My uncles, my cousins, they're all in law. Didn't know why until I found this out, right? My grandfather, Joseph, he married a Burke, right? He married the Burke daughter, one of the daughters. He was a judge. So there we are, the randomized middle class in Jamaica. We have no power besides our fair skin. And therein lies the colorized or colorism that happens in our community. And we got to see that in Tony's book, right?
Right.
The light-skinned girl shows up. And we can't be anything but mad at her. It's like, she's light.
Right.
Why are you upset? She's you, right? No, she has a level of privilege that she gets just from being a lighter tone. She's closer on the spectrum to pretty, to what is good, is to what is desired. And for those who are aware of their privilege, as Tony described ever so accurately, it can and does get abused. If I think about the South American cousins, they will only have light-skinned citizens on television. They will only have the most neutralized of the language spoken on the radio. And we do that here in America as well. You don't have anybody with an accent doing radio unless you are community radio, right, where the community is supporting it. So there is the next layer of toxicity, and that is colorism. And my favorite example, just for more context, would be the island of Hispaniola is split between the Dominican Republic and Haiti, right? Known information. On one side of the island is the Dominican Republic. And from the stars, from the moon, you're taking your shots of the countries, you can see from above that Dominican Republic is green, literally and figuratively lush and green. Yeah. Haiti looks brown. There's not even a body of water reflecting to the stars. Dominican Republic, with the Spanish colonizers, did something very deliberate that also here in America you'll find in New Orleans. And that is when you purposely try to bleed out the color. What do I mean? The white man gets with the black woman. They make a light-skinned child. That child is required to then mate and marry a white person. The resulting grandchildren do not show any evidence of even being black. Now, if you know biology, there's going to be a wild card out there, and somebody's going to pop up. But that is a huge part of our history in Jamaica and here in America for people who were passing.
Yeah. And it all comes back to concepts of beauty. And you know, as you're talking, I'm, you know, sometimes you know something, but you don't realize you know it. And I think I've always thought about beauty, I mean, coming as a white male, is more superficial, is something, you know, it's about self-esteem. And it is about self-esteem. But you're saying, and it makes perfect sense, that it's more than self-esteem. It's actually power. It's economic and political power that is associated with beauty. And so when Piccola is destroyed, she's not just destroyed because she wants to be glamorous or something like that. She's destroyed because she's can't see herself in a society that accepts her. Am I making sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, we threw on top of Piccola's physical appearance, throwing the defamation of her character. I don't care which part of the world you're in, women are valued on their character. And her own father stripped her and ruined her.
Yeah, is that word again?
There's the word.
Yeah.
I bet you she knows what it means now.
Well, Cheryl, I think we're running out of time. Is there any final point you would like to make about The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison?
Everybody, regardless of hue, has a struggle with this material. My own community is not a fan in some pockets with the fact that Tony chose to write about the good, the bad, and the ugly of our experience. It's like laying out your dirty laundry. And there are several, myself included, that have worked in areas that are not known to be friendly to people of color. And I have managed to come out the other end successful. The takeaway for me and the self-reflection that I heard from the author in her own words that she wanted us to have with this book is not to critique Piccola or Charlie or the sisters or anybody of the mothers. It was a critique on us as a society that we are the enablers of these situations. We emasculate the males and take away their choice and their power to be the head of their household. We write policies that encourage families to split apart. We continue to have news and radio and print material that print stories about the worst of us. They don't print stories about the best of us. They don't recognize the power and the strength and the resilience of our women and the beauty of our daughters. Self-loathing did not start yesterday, and it's imbued daily in the way that we show up. These conversations are not for pity parties. They're not for encouraging more graphic representation. It was a Nobel Prize written work that demonstrated the ills and the strengths and the power, and there was love and there was humor. We cannot pull these subjects apart. We have to deal with them together. The total package will need to be unraveled, not bits and pieces of it. Right. And it's going to take a level of not just maturity, but humbleness and meekness to know that you don't have all the answers and you won't have all the answers. But empathy actually comes from knowledge. Sympathy is a reaction. Empathy is a deliberate and informed space.
Oh, that's such a wonderful way to close off the discussion about empathy. I'm so glad you closed with that. Cheryl Cox Williams, thank you so much for this conversation. This has been just a real special thing for me, and I think for our listeners to see this book from your eyes. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate your taking part in this discussion.
Thank you for the invitation again, David, and let's do some more of it.
Let's do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and that's it for Radio Book Club.